Hi, good evening. I'm Town Simon Attic, grateful member CA. Yes. If you had told me 6 years ago I'd be in Milwaukee, what, Wisconsin, I would have said you've been smoking crack. You know, there used to be a time when I would get a call from my dealer and it would cause me to go to the bathroom. Nothing's changed. Now I'm up here doing speaking and it's the same thing. The anxiety sends you to the bathroom. But Ronnie is, I really love that. That was a surprise. Rockin' Ronnie was one of the first people that I met in CA in Central. And I just heard that she's going to speak at World right now. And it's just like, it's just another testament about you guys sitting here, all of us sitting here, that life in recovery is possible. I'm going to go back a little bit and give you some history. I'm one of 16 kids. I was private adopted when I was 2 years old. I have 14 sisters and two brothers. Had 14 sisters and two brothers. I was private adopted by a white woman, my mom, Joan, and she adopted another Native Indian. She was Blackfoot. I'm a Cree Native, so you used to always think that was a bad experiment gone wrong. She should know maybe better. There's no independent or stubbornness in our family, I always say. Being raised in Calgary was a little different. I was in school. When I would go to school, I'd be the only Native when I would go to school. And there wasn't very many Natives in Calgary at the time, even still. Whereas Edmonton, where I live now, there's lots. And I always think, wow, I should have been living in Edmonton. I could have got away with a lot more stuff because I could have blended more, right? But wasn't the case. And, you know, I also grew up in, my mom was head of anthropology at the University of Calgary. She specialized in North American Indians. I was grateful to have the opportunity she brought into my life. Thing was is that she was so busy doing, fighting for our people. She was involved in the Oka and the Lubicon Lake and all the things for our people, fighting for our rights. But me and my sister sadly got lost in that. So I was raised with in a beautiful house. I was raised with we were allowed to travel and stuff. I didn't know for the longest time that people didn't have homes to live in. I didn't know that people didn't get to go to school or people didn't eat and stuff like that. I led a very sheltered life at the beginning. And part of the adoption agreement was that we would go back to the reserve and I would meet my biological family in the summertime. My sister, she was 4 years older than me, and she's the most beautiful sister. She was lighter skin, and so, I mean, when we go to Mexico, she would blend. If we go to Hawaii, she would blend. And she was also the good girl in the family, right? I was the black sheep out of us, the three of us. And I really enjoyed, she also, it seems like to me, like she was always spoiled. I always looked up to her. And then the family dynamics where I was raised, they were all my cousins were 4 years older too. So everybody was older than me. So I was a young brat, black sheep used to run around. And, you know, when I'd go to school and stuff, I wasn't dumb, but I was actually really intelligent. But I would be put outside the classroom because I would be done my work before everybody else. And I would start bugging people. And again, moving around, jittering, stuff like that. And I was always seemed to be getting in trouble, and I always strived. I think a couple of the speakers have already hit on that, the loneliness, right, and loss of identity. So just catch my breath here. So going back to the reserve usually was a good time for me because my aunties and uncles spoiled me when I was there. I'm going to go back again. When I was adopted, my Kokum, which is my grandmother, took us four older girls. We were left in an abandoned house tied to chairs, and she took us and she got us private adopted. So two of my older sisters went to one family in the state. My younger sister went to a different family in the states. And then I went with my mom in Calgary. And it would be later on I would be reunited with my family. I forgot to mention that part. And then so anyways, growing up and school and stuff like that, and my mom would always, because she would always be busy and stuff, she would always put us in camp, she would always put us in these things. So we had all these opportunities, but I didn't have this opportunity to know my mom and to have that intimacy. I would go see my friends, they would all have these this intimate relationships. And when I would go to school, I would get in a lot of fights because people would call me a lot of names. There was a lot of racism in Calgary at the time. And I can remember coming home from school on many times, crawling under my bed and curling up in a ball and crying because everybody hated me. It felt like everybody hated me, and I knew it was because of the color of my skin. And I started hating being brown. And I know my mom, my sister used to get all this attention, and I knew that when I did things bad that I got attention. So I got really good at being bad really fast. I also mentioned I was a little tomboy, and I like being outdoors most of the time. Doing things, I'd rip around on my Coolahara. I still have a bike. I love biking, obviously. And just getting into things. And I really lived in this lifestyle where it was like a fantasy lifestyle. I was like my own best friend and stuff. And I didn't have school friends at school. And I was always trying to fit in and be somewhere and be part of something, right? And knowing I had already been given up once and not wanted. And then the mom that took me in was never around. So I didn't feel wanted then again. And there was no direction. My sister, I was the little brat, right? So we go back up, and so we go to the reserve, and I remember going to the reserve. It'd be 1 week during the summer, and I would love going to the reserve because I'd be spoiled. And my mushroom and my grandfather, which my mushroom is my grandfather, and my uncle was there. My mom was a single white woman. That was the other thing, and she was the first department head at the University of Calgary, which was unheard of at that time. To adopt two different race children was unheard of, and. We go back there, and there was no male figures in our family. And when we go back to reserve, my uncle, my mushroom, they were always like teach me to dance, and I play on the truck, and we build things, and they take me fishing. They were like my surrogate dads, right? And I love that. And I on a couple of visits that I came back when I was older, some sexual assaults happened. And I told one of my biological sisters was out there, and I had told her that her uncle had done some things to me, and she told me it's okay. He does that to me too. It wouldn't be till later on that I find out that wasn't okay. And so I think it was on one of these visits I went back. I remember that I was 7 years old, and I went back to reserve, and this had happened a couple of times now when I'd gone back, and it had spread to a couple of my uncles. And I remember going back, and I was 7 years old, and my sister, we got in a fight like siblings do, and she said, I know something you don't know. And she says, Uncle Johnny's your dad. And I thought, what? That can't be right, because my Kokum had told me, had instilled me, don't lie, be honest, treat your elders with respect. Be honest. And so I went back, I went into the house because everybody was there and it was loud, and I said, is Uncle Johnny my dad? And the whole house went quiet. And I remember that day like it was yesterday. That little girl inside of me, she went to sleep that day. I put her away because I ran next door. I'm Uncle Johnny. I said, are you my dad? And he stopped talking to me until I was 16. So you see how these things were started embedded and stuff, which with a lot of us sometimes have. It's trauma and stuff. So I'm going to skip ahead. So as growing up, after that happened, my mom's very professional. She's also an alcoholic. She used to have a social university faculty club parties with a professor at her house. So we were the coat check girls. We'd coat check the take people's coats, get them their drinks and their food, and then not be seen. Kids were to be heard, not seen. And this was kind of like the lifestyle that it was. And my sister started getting into trouble, but she was allowed to go to school down where we lived in this low-income place. But my mom had sent me to a high-education school. Anyways, as I said, I kept getting in fights with kids, and I kept hating that I was brown. We would literally walk down the street, and people would yell at us and throw things at us. And I just remember that girl. And when I put that girl to sleep that day, I remember I learned how to disassociate, disengage. And that's one of the things I still work on today, is to engage in stuff with some of the trauma. But anyway, so my mom, she's a very social person. It's all about who you are, power, money, and stuff. So she went to go to Montreal to or St. Sever to write a book because she got a sabbatical for a year off. And it was in St. Sever that I lived right across the ski hill. And I used to start skiing there. I found out I was really good at skiing. And I loved adrenaline. This was my love for adrenaline started. And I realized that's a big part of what got me with the dope later on was adrenaline. And when we came back to Calgary, she got me and my sister in a ski team. We started racing for Sunshine Mountain, and I started racing. By this time, I got into junior high, and I started to, I was on the basketball team. I was captain of the basketball team, running team, track team. I was really good at sports. That became my identity of who I was, and I thought that would make me accepted. That didn't make me accepted. It actually made me hated because people thought I was better than them. When we go over to the reserves that were outside of the city, I thought I might fit in there, right, because we're all brown, but they knew I was Cree and they were Blackfoot, and they didn't get along. And I'd fight there too, so it just seemed like this fighting to find out who I was most of my life. In that later on, she was my mom. As I said, my mom was an alcoholic, and she'd have parties and stuff like that. We'd check her coats and stuff, and she would be gone so many times and stuff. So we would start sneaking her booze, you know, and you would be watering it down and stuff like that. And I just much didn't like the taste of it. I sure didn't like the way it made me feel the next day. And my sister was older, so she introduced me to some people that were smoking, and the first party I went to with my older sister, I was so excited to go with my older sister because she's so cool. And we went to this party, and one of the things she told me is never refuse a hoot, never rat out on anybody, and never talk to cops. And so I went to this party, and I didn't refuse a hoot. And the first time I ever got high on drugs, I blacked out. My mom had to get a neighbor to come over to the house because I locked myself into the bathroom. And I just remember waking up the next morning and she's looking on her face and going, oh no, I'm in some trouble now. And, so that kind of, it started like that, and I started stealing things. Again, I was very angry. I was just this young, angry kid. And I put my finger up to the world, and I started self-harming. I started punching walls so I could feel. I would punch walls until my knuckles would bleed, because then I could actually feel, because I had stopped feeling. I was had what's that word I use? Disassociation and stuff, right? And that started into cutting myself, and then I started cutting myself. And I was like this back and forth person. I started getting in trouble. I was in front of the judge just before my 11th birthday for the first time, and last time I was in front of the judge was, I think, 4 years ago. Yes. And actually, it was 2 weeks ago, but it wasn't for me. But that started happening. But then as my school grades started failing, you know, I started showing up for my finals on acid, and you know, and then the phone call to the parents and they come get you out and you're expelled. And you know, I'll get expelled from this school, I'll get expelled from that school, I'm in front of the judge again, I'm in the juvie hall now. That was the other thing. I matured quite easily, and we were like, my mom didn't like men, right? And I was seeking this attention. When we go to juvie hall, there'd be like ratio 10 men to 10 boys to one woman, and I would get that attention. And juvie hall was so different than it was now, but I kept being involved in that stuff. And then when and I was a pattern person, like I would run away and then I would come back and say sorry mom, and she would have all these crazy expectations that nobody could possibly do. And and I would try again. So there's always this fight to get up and to try again. There was something different. I didn't want life to be the way that sometimes I felt it was. And I started going. My sister ended up going to a group home, and she sent me to a group home. And I remember in the group home, we all had chores to do, and they made me do laundry. And I said, I don't know how to do laundry. He said, that's ridiculous, you know. I said, no, I don't. And so I had this bleach and all the soaps and stuff like that. And just so happened, everybody had their clothes in that load of laundry, and I bleached them all. And so the good part was I never had to do laundry again. But the whole thought of that, when I'd gone home for that weekend TA, I thought, wow, we chose clothes white. So I went home and I bathed myself in bleach so that I could be white, so that I could be loved and be a part of the world, finally. All that happened is I ended up getting a really bad rash. But, you know, today I'm grateful for that because I love the color of my skin and I love who I'm from, right? You know, so that continued, but it's what started happening was when I met these kids in the group homes and stuff, I met some street kids, and they were different than the kids that I had known. They had absolutely horrific lifestyles that I had never even heard of before. As I said, my mom kept me sheltered, and, you know, they started hanging out. I started hanging out with them. They accepted me, and I liked that. It didn't matter that I was brown. It didn't matter anything, and they hung out with me, and I love that. And I was willing to do whatever it was to take to do it. And of course, there was some things. There were some things I knew I shouldn't do that I started doing. You know, I started stealing my mom's car. I started stealing her credit cards. I started forging checks. Back in front of the judge, got kicked out of all of Calgary, had to go to Edmonton, got kicked out of Edmonton, back to Calgary. You know what, I always come back to Calgary. As I got old, but it was so weird, in the wintertime, I would still go skiing. I would always be good and make it back for wintertime because I could go skiing because I love that. But it also became one of my mom's things. I was like her trophy girl. Look what I've done with this native. I felt that way. That wasn't the way it was, but I felt that way. My mom worked with John Reed, Ken Reed's dad at the university, and he was doing some sponsorship for the Canadian ski team, and I was that good that he let me try out. I came in second place for a Canadian tryout team. And it was for downhill racing, and I didn't want a downhill race anymore because freestyle had started. And I love freestyle, but it wasn't considered an Olympic sport, so my mom wouldn't pay for me anymore. And that was the only connection that I had to her. By this time, my sister was out on her own and everything like that. My only role model was my probation officer, and she told me that I could go on this independent living, which my mom kept threatening me with, that she'd put me on independent living. In the neighborhood that I live in, it's really low key. We call it the hood in Calgary and stuff. And anyways, I'd be walking down the street and I'd be hanging out with my friends and we'd be partying and stuff like that. And end up meeting this guy and my friends would trade booze for sex, right? And so I'm not going to be that person. I'm not going to be that girl. And this guy, he came out and he was giving me booze, stuff like that. And then it was money and stuff like that. And I didn't know till later on this guy had groomed me and he taught me to give oral sex and stuff like that. At which point, I had gone out and started making money for the first time. And I thought, I'm making my own money. I'm not giving it away for free like the other girls are doing and stuff like that. So, I mean, it was this total self-destruction. I was in total self-destruct mode, and I was mad at the world, and I wanted the world to know if you were going to push me out, you were going to watch me go. And, I was in at a party when I was 12 years old, just after my 12th birthday, and I ended up getting gang raped, and I ended up getting pregnant from that rape. And it was just before my 13th birthday. We went to get an abortion in Hawaii, and I remember telling my mom that I had got raped, and she said it was my fault because of the way I dressed. I know that's not true today either, right? When we were 13, we were in Hawaii, and I had an abortion. It was Christmas, and we had to sit there with all these other families. And I remember feeling like I had nobody, and I was alone, which I had felt before. It was a comfortable feeling. This is something I got used to, this feeling. And again, I would start cutting myself and everything. And then, I'm just going to skip it up to the thing. So I ended up on the streets of Calgary. I ended up hanging out with these bikers. They adopted me. I ended up, you know, selling drugs. I ended up selling myself. I ended up being collection. I'd go collect things and stuff. In Calgary, this is when the women, my sisters, were going missing in Vancouver, and there were memorials happening all the time. And so we were on high alert on the street, and all, you know, it's just a lifestyle that you, that I was living in the high-risk lifestyle, and I was in the wrong place at the wrong time, and I got thrown out of a two-story window, and I collapsed 3 discs in my back. They told me I never walked again. I did 6 months later, but I walked out with a morphine and Demerol addiction. They gave me pills when I left, and when I took the pills, I was like, you must have given me the wrong pills. They're not working like Jovenus was. And so I had a good friend show me how I could get that to make them work again. And that started my shooting career. At that time, you didn't have, there wasn't all this safe work, the safety needle work and everything like that. I can remember being in Hastings, Vancouver, buying a rig for $5 at the back of this guy's van because we're stealing some diabetic lady's needles and stuff like that. And so I continued on this lifestyle, and it just got worse and worse and worse. And again, this is what was happening. I was going to all these memorials for my sisters because I thought, you know, I have to go because one of those that's going to be me one of those days on memorial. Nobody's going to show up for me. So I have to show up for these women, right? And then this was going down, and my girlfriend was having a bad date on the street, and I went over to go see if she was okay. She was okay. I went to walk away, and her date hit me in the truck, and I guess I went fine like 10 feet, but I was on a mission to go meet my dealer, so I got up and went across the street to meet my dealer, went over to my friend's house to phone. This would be the first time I ended up in a CA convention. I went in the hotel, used the phone to phone my buddy, and some guy just grabbed me, says, you need to come with me. I'm like, what? And then we go into this big room like this, and everybody's holding hands, kumbaya, and I'm like, what's happening here? And he says, you need this. He says, this is cocaine anonymous. And all I heard was cocaine. I thought, I can get some here. And then I'm like looking around, but out of the 200 people, only maybe 20 people look like they did cocaine. And I thought, and then he explained to me, it's for people who have quit. And then I was just like, oh my God, they all know. And I was out of there. Phoned my friend, went to my friend's place. By this time I had stayed up for days, right? Because that's what you do. You stay up until sleep deprivation kicks in. You start seeing things, you know, you get your money's worth, right? You know? I went to my friend's place and I passed out on his couch. I woke up and I couldn't walk. I couldn't feel my legs. I couldn't do anything like that. And I always say it was a good thing I got hit by that truck because it wouldn't take me to the hospital for 2 weeks because they also knew me in Calgary everywhere, the ambulances, the cops and stuff like that. And I regularly use ambulances to get ride places or to get drugs places. And so they were like, Ryan, walk to the thing. And I couldn't. It took me 2 weeks to get in there. By the time I got it in there, they had told me I had endocarditis, spotting on the valve to my heart, this infection, and it had slowly eaten the cartilage off my hip bone, so much so that my left leg was shorter by an inch and a half, but I didn't feel it. And thank goodness I got hit by that truck, because if I didn't get hit by that truck, it would have spread to my spine. I would have been paralyzed, they told me. I spent another 10 months in the hospital, and I did walk again. Not right away, though. I needed a hip replacement, and I was on crutches for 3 years, which then the Calgary court system sent me to Edmonton, and I had to do time there, and I ended up going to the place called Pound Makers. And I did keep going to treatments all along this. Like, I would keep trying. I would keep trying to change my life. I would do the geological change. I went to Prince George to treatment. I went to 3 treatments in Calgary, the same one. The first time I went, I lasted 2 hours. I saw a guy walking. I know that walk. I left. Next time I lasted 2 days. Next, finally, I lasted the whole time. And one time I had gone to Vancouver to a women's treatment center there. And the day I got out of there, I thought I'd go down to Hastings to check and see if my tool belt was working. And it wasn't working. And I ended up down there for 3 years with a $300 a day heroin addiction. And I can remember there was this hotel, the Balmoral, and I can remember dying in that alley twice because, see, I love to push it to the, I like to be all you can be. Of dope, right? You know, people would say, I can't get high anymore. Oh, yeah? I'll show you. So I was like this, like, seriously, ODing was my thing. My dad had taken the door off the bathroom because I used to OD so much, and I always knew I did because people would have that look on their face like they were looking at a ghost. And, you know, it got to the point where my dealers were telling me, you know, they wouldn't give me dope, right? I would be speaking perfect English, but to them I was speaking Cokanese, and they didn't understand what I was saying, and they tell me, you need to go to sleep, Tanis, right? And I would go to these treatments, and I finally would go to Bonneville Treatment Center outside of Edmonton. And when I went to go get my medical done and stuff like that, I found out that I found out about forgiveness at this place. And I thought, okay, well, I need to forgive my mom. So I called my mom to forgive her, and I found out she passed away from cirrhosis of the liver 2 weeks before. So I wasn't able to give her, make her amends, right? So I did well for a little while, and then one day I realized that I was doing so well, I looked around and I thought, shit, karma, man. Karma's going to come get me, right? So instead of waiting for the hammer to fall, I made the hammer fall because everything was good. Something had to go bad because everything was good in my life. It was the success that freaked me out. And so I went back out, and I went back into Bonneville again the second time I went in there. And when I went to go... when I marbled out of that and I went to go do my medical to go to this other treatment center, my friend, the lady had told me that my sister that I grew up with had hung herself. And so I never got to make amends to her. So I always thought it was really weird because we all thought it was going to be me, even by 20, that was going to be the first one to go. And I'm still here. Somebody has to stick around and tell the stories, you know, and share their experience. And so I'm going to skip forward anyways. I did this whole trip, and, you know, I would sell on the street, and I remember standing on the street. I would be dope sick. I'd have cotton fever. I'd have to go get my pickups. I'd be on crutches. You know, it just seemed like this big circle jerk was going on, and it seemed like that street was like a treadmill, right? It was like this ongoing treadmill, and I would see people driving by, and I would be so jealous. I'd be like, they're going somewhere. They have somewhere to go. They have people to be with. Right, they're going to do something. And anyways, you know what, I again went into treatment, and it would have been 6 years ago Christmas. It was the last time that I would go into treatment, but it was Christmas Day, and it was the first time that I did not want to get clean. All the other times I had gone to treatment, I wanted to get clean. This last time I went in, I did not want to get clean. I went in because of circumstances, because that had happened. I had finally had an apartment. It was Christmas Day. I had all this money. I had all this dope. I had this fantasy in my thing that was going to be old school again, and everything was going to be great. Now I was thinking about, who am I going to share this with? And I thought, there's nobody that's not going to jack me or cap me to share this with. And it was a horrible feeling. And so I sat there for hours on Christmas Day, and I ended up with such bad abscesses and stuff on my legs that by the time I phoned the ambulance and came and got me, they take me to a chair, took me down to the hospital. And when I was in the hospital and they checked me over, they told me that they're probably going to have to amputate my legs from the knees down. You want to stop doing dope, right? No, because now I got a pick inside me. Now I can mainline. Now I'm not going to miss and be Pocahontas like I always was. I was a Pocahontas, not the nice, beautiful Indian one. I was just the Pocahontas. And I was like, you know, and so... And I don't know what happened to this day, but I left, and but I know the system. I'll come in, I'll tell them I'm going to treatment, I'll get the judge off my back. By the way, I had a 7-year pen bit hanging over my head for a 4-year, for my fourth trafficking, and my health was failing. I ended up going to Bonneville for the last time, and if from Bonneville, my plan was to just, because there was nowhere I could hit myself anymore. Everything was callous and collapsed, and that was the main reason why I was going to treatment. The main reason was so I could heal again. The second one was so I could put a couple of checks back to back. You know what? You're going to do that every month, be that entrepreneur. And then, like, a couple hours later, you're like, oh, man, next month. And, you know, I ended up going to... I just want to add, you never had any real relationships in when I was out there, right? Because then you'd have to share. It was really meaty. So I didn't have any kind of relationships there. And also, it was a good thing I was not healthy either. But so anyways, I went into this place called Wellsprings. It's a 1-year women's treatment program. And it's a Christian-based treatment program. And so because I didn't want to be there, because I wasn't really wanting to be there, but I didn't want to go to the jail even more than that, right? The fear of going to jail and being in my own head with my own mind and a whole bunch of women around me on menstrual period and menstrual cycles running my ass over, it was not something that I wanted to sign up for. So that motivated me to go to stay at this treatment center. And I remember... you know what, I remember the first few nights sleeping, and I remember the first few nights eating, right? And I remember And I remember the staff there, and I remember all the staff seemed to be half my age. And I thought, what do you got to offer me? Do you even know what weed is, right? You know, these staff were amazing. I always say creators spoil me and specifically put people in my path, and continues to still do so. So I started this 1-year program, and from 8, 9, and 10 in the morning, we used to do Bible study. I used to think that was total unfair punishment, and they're like, and I didn't know God. My mom didn't talk to me about God. I didn't know my culture. So, you know, all these things were starting to happen. Now all of a sudden I've got accountability and structure around me, and they told me you have to get a sponsor, which you have to get a signature each week, right? And you have to go to a certain amount of meetings and stuff. And that's how I ended up at CA, not because I wanted to, because it was the closest and I was lazy. This is where I met Rockin' Ronnie, man. And I remember going down those stairs, and I remember sitting there and feeling I don't belong here either, because a lot of people had jobs, had houses and stuff like that. And I always just had this core belief that I wasn't worth anything, right? But again, the motivation not to go to jail for 7 years was stronger. So I started doing all the things they told me. I got a sponsor. I did work. They got me chair. My sponsor got me chair within the first 30 days. And I remember getting up and standing, sitting up in front of the room. And I felt like my head wanted to pop off and I wanted to run, because I'm a runner, right? And I remember introducing myself to a guy earlier so I would know to be able to call up someone's name. He told me his name was Julio. Well, his name was not Julio. His name was Jim. But apparently it was a big funny joke. And so now I call him Julio. So I can remember my face going red and the adrenaline rushing, and I was totally out of my comfort zone like I have not been in my life. I want to emphasize on that, because everything that's happened to me since then has happened because I've got out of my comfort zone, and there's freedom. We talked about that today. There's so much freedom from getting out of your comfort zone and going. We pass around numbers and stuff like that. I have not had one phone call from people, but we have no problem phoning a dealer, phoning the next dealer. You know, we go until we can go, right? You know, and anyway, so. I stayed at this program, and my day was crazy. I was practicing my medicine wheel now. I would be at the gym at 6 o'clock in the morning because I need that adrenaline. I'm an adrenaline junkie. I love adrenaline. I like the rush of it, right? And I can get a natural rush when I go to the gym. And when I got into Wellsprings and stuff, what I did with my first money, which was really funny because I'd have $2,000 on the street at night and I'd have nothing to show for it in the morning. I had more money on the street, but less to show for it. And I had less money in recovery, but now I have more to show for it. And one of the first investments I bought was a bike. I always say I traded my pipe in for my bike, and it got me way better, more places than my pipe ever did, right? You know? And I started being a service. This was the Hope Mission. I also had to go in front of the judge, and I was going to, part of the thing is you have to go to the gym too and stuff like that. So I would do that. I would go to the gym and I would bring my books because I have a hard time focusing and sitting down and doing still. So to do the steps was difficult for me. To open up the big book and sit down there and read and do my steps was difficult. I had to bring my book to the meeting, because when shit's all loud and stuff like that, that's when my head goes quiet. And that's when I can do stuff. I listen to heavy metal and drink coffee. That's how I go to sleep. So, you know, a little bit of ADHD, OCD, and all that, right? You know, but this new way of living, I went to all the fellowships. I did service in all the fellowships. My days was filled from 6 o'clock to 10:30 at night when my probation officer would phone to see if I was in the thing, at the treatment center. And I remember my friend, people were talking to me about God and stuff like that, and we'd have prayer class and stuff like that, right? And I finally said to him, I said, you know what, if you're here, you need to prove to me that you're here by taking the obsession away, because that's what took me out every single time, was that obsession, right? And the craving, the 60,000 thoughts a day, I can manifest them to make them all around drugs and where I use, who I use, who I was going to use with, what I was going to do, my next plan, stuff like that, you know. And I would, and so I sat there and I prayed to this God, and I was expecting burning bush and there was nothing. I thought, yeah, pretty much what I thought, right? But it was somewhere like 2 weeks later where I was sitting there and I thought, I sit down one day and I thought, hey, when is the last time I thought of using dope? I didn't think of using dope today. I didn't think of using dope yesterday. And I had figured out it was somewhere in that two-week period that I had stopped thinking about dope. So I patted myself on my back and said, good job, Tanis. You did it. And this voice said, no, you didn't. I did. You asked me, and I did that, right? And I'm thinking, okay, maybe there is something to this, right? You know, so I'm figuring I'm on a roll, right? I've got to go to court for the 7-year pen bit, right? And meanwhile, we're doing the gym and stuff like that. And one of my friends, she had quit smoking and stuff like that. And people were telling me to find the God in my understanding, and that there'll be signs, right? And I remember thinking that song, sign everywhere, sign. Because, man, I couldn't see the sign. And I was sitting there, and I went to the gym one day, and I was high, and she had talked about quitting smoking. I thought, probably doesn't make sense to go and do a workout and then light a cigarette, right? So I left the gym, I had a smoke, and I was riding my bike, and it went out. And I thought, well, that was weird, but no big deal. Lit it again, went down the second block, it went out again. And I thought, is this that sign thing? No. And I lit it again, and I went down to the third block, and it went out again, and I literally stopped my bike, and I was like, what? And I looked up, and there's a big billboard sign that said, you still don't get it? That's how my higher power talks to me, boy, because I understand sarcasm. So it's the way you understand him, right? And I understand sarcasm, I understand humor, and I understand stubbornness, and that's how we connect, right? That's how I'm able to connect with him. And I'm telling you, I have not stopped seeing signs everywhere. I saw them on TV, I saw them through people, I heard them through songs. You know, it was just crazy. My awareness had just amplified. All my senses had come back, and I want to say I was starting to do the steps. I had got a sponsor. Things were starting to happen. And what happened? That 7-year-old little girl woke up with a spiritual awakening, and my freedom started happening. And she started, Tanis was being set free. And from there on, I was just like on this crazy freaking roll. I went to court. I was praying, please don't send me to the pen. And I ended up walking out with deuce less a day to spend as a CSO. And I had fines I had to pay. So I started doing work with Salvation Army. They used to pick me up on the stroll and give me food and stuff like that and tell me be safe and everything like that. And there was this chick that was on there. You saw, always want to pray for me. I said, don't pray for me. And because I didn't want her to pray for me because there was no one saving me. But anyways, I seen her at a meeting. She said, hey, you're looking really good. I don't think you know who I am. And I'm like, no, I don't. She says, oh, I was on the Salvation Army. I used to pick you up on the stroll. And I'm like, oh, do you still do that? And she's like, yeah. And I'm like, can I come do that with you? And she's like, sure, this week. And I'm like, no. And it's like, you want me to drive around the stroll? Like, I'm only 3 months clean. I don't think it's a good idea, you know, picking up all the buddies I used to use with. But I did end up going and working with her. I ended up going on that van ministry for 2 years every Friday night with her. Everything that I took back in my out there on the street, I got to give back at the Hope Mission. I started serving the homeless instead of being the homeless. I not only finished my program, they hired me there. I was a woman's outtake worker there. I ended up going before my 2-year sentence was done to ask the judge if I could go on a missions trip to Africa. The judge came down and shook my hand. What? And it gets crazier. The Crown Prosecutor wanted to shake my hand. Now that's what blew me away, because that guy never had nothing good to say about me, right? And just because of there's duress in there, I wasn't able to go to there. And then I finished my sentence. I quit. And the day I got sentenced, I quit smoking. I didn't smoke for 5 years. I did start up again. I am human. That was a couple of months ago. But from there, my life just radically changed. I got introduced to people. I was involved in service. I was the liaison for the George Spady, which was a detox that I had been to over 100 times. Probably it was sadly my home away from home. I was the H&I liaison for that. My sponsor told me to go to an area meeting where they said that it's not about politics and stuff, but everybody was voting. I thought, this is a lie. And I remember they were discussing all these jobs, and it was jobs were going up, right? And I remember listening to this one job and thinking, oh man, poor sucker who's getting that job, right? And then all I hear say, I nominate Tanis. I'm like, yeah, I've been nominated. I'm a part of something. I was so excited just to be nominated, just to find out 5 minutes later, oh, it was that job you just bought that was really going to suck. And I ended up being in hospitality at the convention and ended up doing table settings and stuff like that. And finally, I started belonging and stuff. And one of the things I want to say, early on when I had gone out, we did this sketchy fun days. I call it sketchy fun days, but it was fun days, but I call it sketchy because the things we were doing. And I remember I had gone on the back of my friend's bike, right? Debt, and my friend Mike, he had his Harley and he had Maiden pounding down, and we were driving out to the Winterburn to do this fun days, and I was smiling like I ate a bag of shrooms, but I was sober and I was like sucking back bugs, and I was like happy. I was like happier than I'd never been happy before, right? And I felt a part of something, and I felt fun. I felt that fun happening, right? Like, recovery, why get recovery if you don't have fun? And we just get to the Olympics, and it was just really weird because I thought, what am I doing down on the floor again? They had this game where you had to get down on the floor and shoot marbles. I thought, what am I doing? I thought, you're in recovery, I shouldn't be back down on the floor again, right? You know? And then we're doing stack the cans like we used to do when we were drinking, right? And I was like, what? This is just like sketchy Olympics, right? And then we had this game called Blow the Joker. I knew I was going to be good at that one, right? And I won all these t-shirts and all this stuff, right? And that was it. That's it begun. That feeling started. And from where I didn't want recovery now, it was funny because I ended up getting 110% of it because I gave 110% of it. They say do whatever you do in recovery, what you did out there, you know, do it in recovery. And my drug of choice was more or yours, you know? And, my crack bone was connected to my morphine bone. My morphine bone was connected to my heroin bone, and I usually broke out in handcuffs. That was a story, right? You know, so like I say, my life has radically changed because I got involved in service and because I got involved in community. I started sitting on community boards with people that had helped me when I was etching and sketching out there, right? You know, itchy and scratchy. I was like itchy and sketchy, right? Itchy from the morphine and sketchy from the crack, and I was like this windmill like this, right? Like Ronnie was right. When I came in, I was like this, right? And I was probably up like that till up to 3 years ago, and I still sometimes am like that, right? She was right, though. My eyes did get off the floor, and I was able to look you in the eye. I was able to look myself in the mirror. I started sitting on community boards. I started getting to travel. I got involved with things that I took from, like I said, murdered and missing women. I started being a spokesman and an advocate for that. Human trafficking. I ended up being invited to the World Human Trafficking in UK. That's huge. Like, I went from the block, sketching out on a block on a corner of my office, to sitting in UK at a World Trafficking and Human Conference, right? Being a part of it. I've since been invited back twice. The second time I went back for the 150th Salvation Army anniversary. That's a once in a lifetime deal thing, man. I'm telling you, you're in a sea arena with 80,000 soldiers and majors in 126 countries Skyping and worshiping across the world, and I'm sitting right beside the woman that used to start the van that used to come pick me up when I was sketching on the stroll. I got to go back again, invited back again to train people on human trafficking and awareness for 3 months. I've been allowed to travel this world and speak and share my experience and hope with you. One of the most beautiful things is my family has come back. I have my daughter in my life. I have two grandsons. They've never seen me stoned or messed up, and they never have to. And my one grandson, he's like 8 years old and 110 pounds, and I don't want him to see me messed up or be mad at me. He's a big little Nietzsche. You know, he's going to be a real big Nietzsche and stuff. But, you know, it hasn't always been easy. As I said, I have 14 sisters. I've lost five of them. This disease kills. This disease takes people out. I know when I came here, my big passion is whenever I go in here is take me to the hood. Tim took me to the hood around here and took me to the hood and drove around. And you know what? They may look different, but it's all the same. You know, people are hurting. People are struggling. People are dying. The drugs aren't getting better. The drugs are getting worse. And our fellowship alone, we lose someone every week. You know, that's the reality of it. You know, to the people, I know you guys are here from treatment, and I know you guys got to get going, so I'm going to just end it up here. But I just want to say, like, I was queen of relapses, queen of hopeless. Even to the people on the street, I was the lowest of the lows, right? But now my life has radically, like I say, radically changed, and I get to now empower and impact. I'm involved in this journey team where we take women off the street, and we take them out for 3 days, and they just get pampered on, right? I get to be involved when I go to the UK. They're the ones that take women that are coming being out of trafficking, right? You know, and I get to be a part of that. My life is still extreme. I go from Pismo Beach, California, sitting in a conference with world leaders to sitting downtown LA, walking through the streets of tents of people that are homeless and damn, you know. I sat in a hospital bed with ICU with my sister. She died of cancer. My other sister, she OD'd last year. My youngest sister got hit by a car. Things, life don't start happening, but we learn to deal with it. Now today, when I actually feel pain, this guy gave me one of the greatest lessons. He said, when you feel pain, he said he was crying, he felt pain. Someone said to him, he said, why don't you just pray for that pain to go away? And he says, no, I don't want to pray for the pain to go away. I want to pray for what the pain is supposed to show me, what lesson I'm supposed to get, what freedom I'm supposed to get from it. Because without any kind of pain, without any kind of trauma, it doesn't give us a chance to grow and to change and to look at ourselves. And as addicts here, we got that gift. And you guys are all uniquely beautiful spirit people with your own unique spectrum of colors and light that shine, and you're here for a reason today, at this moment, at this time, because you're worth it, and there's somebody watching you and wants to see you succeed and find that person inside you, that little girl or that little boy, to wake up and get that spiritual awakening. Yeah. So I always say, stick around, popcorn on the floor will just be popcorn on the floor.